This is the mind detectives calling that boy they call the Riot. Anyway, if you see him, tell him hi.
Telling you, bro. What's been happening, bro?
Not too much.
Still hitting more Peggy O's.
Hey everybody, welcome back to Riff Raff. Thanks so much for tuning in. Greetings from Paris, France. Day off here, and it's been a fun European tour. Darryl Hall, John Oates. Second time I've been to Europe this year. It's really nice, always great. And I thought I'd take this day off to put the final touches on this episode of Riff Raff for you. So look, if you haven't already done so, please give me a good review on iTunes for Riff Raff. A lot of people have done that. It's really great. Leave a nice comment. You can follow me on Instagram and Facebook, Shane Terrio Music, Shane Terrio Guitar on Instagram. Love hearing from all you guys. I'm not going to run my mouth a lot on the intro this time, so let's just get to today's guest. My guest today is Mr. Wayne Krantz. Wayne's one of my favorite guitar players, favorite musicians. I go check him out every time I get the chance when I'm up in New York. And it's always inspiring. And I've had a lot of requests. You guys hit me up all the time on email with requests for Riff Raff. And Wayne has always been there at the top of the list, so here we go. I made it happen. This is really a great interview. I mean, I really loved sitting and playing with Wayne. He was so nice to come over. He actually lives down the street from my apartment in Manhattan, so it worked out great. I mean, you know, Wayne is one of the more original guitar players out there on the scene now. He's been at it shortly after moving to New York in 1987. He talks about how he made a decision which impacted his music and style to this day, and that was to completely abandon any preconceived licks, cliches, and he totally reinvented himself. I mean, really an inspiring thing and a challenging thing, because he was scraping for a while before he, you know, he came into his own, and people know him for his original voice now. It's a real path of an artist. He's got a highly original approach to the instrument. I love the way he takes chances. He trusts his ideas and goes with them. I mean, he's a true improviser. So in this interview, we talk about, you know, Steely Dan, the importance of time, centering the note, challenges and rewards of leading an original project in New York. Wayne also has many solo records out. He's working on a new one now that he talks about. I mean, there's the classic Two Drink Minimum. There's Howie 61, Good Piranha, Bad Piranha, which I used on this intro. I mean, I love all his stuff, and it's all different. He has a new revision to his book, The Improviser's OS, version 2, which you guys all need to check out. Go to WayneKrantz.com. He's got all his info there. And here we go. Wayne, like I said, he was nice enough to come over, walk down the street, walks in, and we start playing. I was playing like some little groove, and Wayne just jumped in, and man, it sounds like a tune all of a sudden when Wayne starts playing. So hope you enjoy it. Thanks for listening.
Where was one on that?
3, 4, 1. Thanks, Wayne, for coming over, man.
My pleasure, Shane.
Down the street here.
It took 7 minutes to get here, so I'm exhausted.
I almost called you again because I heard the jackhammer this morning. I mean, we're in New York.
Are they
City
likely
folks,
to start
so.
Up?
Huh?
Are they likely to start up?
No, I don't think so. I almost went across the street and asked them, but I'm sure they wouldn't.
Just tell them you're doing a podcast. I'm sure they'd be happy to stop.
Could you guys hold it down for me? Somebody told me a story once that they used to live in New York in the 80s, and they were working like this, and Rodney Dangerfield came down in a robe and was asking, "Oh, you got to be working here."
That's great.
But I don't think I would have gotten the same reaction had
probably
I tried
not.
That. Anyway,
depending on the robe.
Well, look, you know, I was telling you when you walked in, all you know, my little Labor of Love podcast here, the listeners I have, man, I've gotten so many people that have hit me up. If you can get Wayne Krantz,
that's very
so you're
far
on
up.
My, you know, top of the list.
I'm glad. Hell yeah.
And all the times I go down the 55 bar and hear you, man, it's always great. It's always different.
Is that cool? Is the difference cool? Sometimes I worry about it. I mean, that's the way I like it, but I you know, I know people also like not different sometimes, you know.
Really?
They like, yeah, I mean, it's a weird, I always think about this, you know, it's like just to try to, you know, make the people happy. And so I know that there are certain people like it when, you know, you were talking about Jeff Beck before. It's like they like it when they can go hear Jeff and Jeff does Jeff. You know, they know what that is. They've listened to it. They love it. And what we do is, so in a way, I mean, it's always us, you know, it's always, it always sounds like me, I guess. I mean, I would think.
Absolutely.
I can't help it, you know, but it might not always be exactly the same angle of it, you know, and sometimes I wonder about that, like, do people, whether they're disappointed, because sometimes, like, and I kind of heard it in your voice, too, when you said it's different all the time, it's kind of, there's a little bit, like, you can kind of go either way with it. Like,
no,
it's cool in one way.
I mean it as a compliment. I mean, the way the way I hear it, and the way I would take that, most people that I hear talk about you after, because everybody's like, wow, I went here Wayne last night and this and that. I hear it as, it's always you. Like you said, Jeff sounds like Jeff. I think Wayne always sounds like Wayne. But the thing that makes it interesting is, and maybe it's out of necessity being in New York, you have this revolving cast of rhythm section,
right,
but they frame you.
Uh-huh.
But you're always the centerpiece. I mean, it's always fresh. That's what I mean. You know, it's good.
Well, that's cool. That's great.
Yeah.
But I mean, it's just, you know, there's so much improvising in it. Almost all of it is improvised. So more than usual, it really matters who's playing.
Sure.
Like, because they're given a third of it, each of them, you know.
And I get that I feel that the drums drive it a lot, too, depending
totally
on who's driving the thing.
Yeah.
But you're
absolutely
manning the show for sure. I mean, it's... And, you know, I think last time I went down there a month or so ago, we were talking at just watching everybody bob their heads in unison. You
mm-hmm
know, all these, everybody loves the kids come out and hear you.
Mm-hmm.
I think people tend to hear things in one or two bar phrases now. Maybe that's what we were talking about that night. And your music, as complex as it can get, and it appeals to, you know, guitar players and advanced musicians, it also appeals to people who just want to groove.
I hope so. That's
yeah
the foundation. You know?
Absolutely.
Without that, it's...
The rhythmic thing is
yeah
so strong.
Yeah, and the short phrases are definitely where it's at with that stuff. It's, I mean, that's how I... That's really how I play. I mean, that's how I think when I'm playing. I'm always kind of thinking in terms of the, like, two and four bar phrases and you know, expanding that lots, too. But that's really the foundation of it. It's just the shorter phrase thing, as opposed to the jazz thing, which tends to be more long phrase stuff.
Right.
You know? And connecting phrases and stuff like that. So it's built in a different way that really lends itself more to pocket stuff.
Let's see, there's a lot of stuff I want to ask you.
Great.
The first time I ever heard you on a recording was, I think it was a Lainey Stern record.
You know which one?
I know the tune was called Phoenix.
Yeah, I think that might be my song. It might be one of my tunes.
Yeah.
That's probably on Closer to the Light.
That sounds right.
Called.
Yeah.
I think that was the one with, I believe, that was the one that Dave Sanborn played a solo on.
Oh, wow.
I have a cool story about that if you're interested.
Yeah, absolutely.
Sorry to interrupt. Yeah, he did an overdub on the thing. And I think, as I think about it, I'm thinking it may have been the first time I ever saw a cell phone in my life. And his cell phone that he had in the studio, he kind of sheepishly brought it out. It was like walkie-talkie size.
It was like a brick.
It really was. It was giant. But, you know, it was like one of those military field phones. Maybe like a little smaller. But it was just the most amazing thing. That was a telephone that somebody was carrying around. You know, it was just beyond belief. But even more moving and memorable and important was the fact that as I was watching him do this overdub, which I'd never seen him do, just a solo on a track, you know, at the time he was, I can't remember when, that was probably in the 90s somewhere, he, like, anything related to funk in terms of saxophone was pretty much a direct cop of him. Like,
yeah,
everybody looked to him for instruction about how to be funky with a saxophone. And I remember, in fact, Michael Brecker told me once that hell for him was following Sanborn on a funk tune.
Wow.
Like, he was really, and, you know, probably still is, I mean, for all I know, the man for that. And so everybody was imitating him. Everybody, you know, stood like he stood and kind of angled their mouths to the mouthpiece like he does, and then the signature lick stuff. But as I listened to him do this overdub, I realized that all anybody was getting of him were just these really superficial little kind of idiosyncrasies of his playing. That was really the only part of it that anybody is capable of imitating. Because the real thing that he does, the organic thing, is much rawer and much less kind of polished and casual. And it's quite earthy and organic and really personal and kind of dark, actually. Like, and it became apparent that that was really the foundation of what he was. But none of that stuff is very easily copped. And so that got me thinking, like, about, like, what people imitate in other people. And I suspect, I mean, I've thought a little bit about it since then, I suspect it's usually those superficial things. Because the real deep thing that anybody has is, you know, probably more or less uncoppable. Just like you can't really cop the personality of a person, you know. You can kind of get the little jokes they tell, you know, but that's about it. I had a similar vibe once watching Donald Fagen and Walter Becker recording in the studio, like just the two of them. It was on a recording session, and they were just the two of them in the studio, and they were just kind of jamming. The two of them were just playing, and completely casually, like just not even a tune, I don't think. And I was listening to it, and I was just struck that it sounded exactly like Steely Dan. Like, them just jamming.
Just the core.
Sounds like the record that, and at that time, like, everybody was trying to imitate, I want to play like the guys on the Dan records, you know? So everybody's, like, working their asses off to try to cop this thing that these guys do falling out of bed. They can't help but sound like that, you know, that they're not trying to sound that way. They are that way.
Right.
You know?
Right.
It's such a deep thing. And it's really, I think we all have that. You know, we all have our thing. This is it's interesting, you know, that bit of it. Because so much of, like, learning how to play is kind of an imitative process, you know. It's like people like somebody, so they want to sound like that person. And what that means and where that leads them and to what degree it's possible. I remember when I was a kid, the first time I heard George Benson play on record, I immediately tried to figure it out, because when you're a kid, that's what you do. You figure out every single thing you hear that you like. And I was shocked that when I finally, and this is on an LP, right? So you're kind of like scratching the record to smithereens as you're trying to learn this fast stuff. And I remember realizing, like, once I got the notes, it felt like there was nothing there. It's like, it doesn't sound like anything when I play these notes. But when he plays the notes, it blows my mind. Mm. And that was like my little lesson about it ain't the notes, kid.
There's more than the note.
Yeah.
Definitely. I think Alan Holdsworth, I had read somewhere where he said, why would a grown man want to imitate another man's
Actually, I said that myself in an interview.
Maybe it's
once.
You. You said the grown man part.
Well, that's the ego part of it.
Been dying to ask you about it, because I've tried to actually find podcasts. Yeah, I think you've only done one. I haven't seen hardly any interviews, but there I had a long interview a long time ago with you where you talked about just shedding all preconceived, like all your bebop cliches, and like back in the, I don't know when that would have been, but you made a very conscious decision to shed everything and start from zero and, like, you know, just become, not become original, but focus more on
what I had personally.
your personal sound.
Yeah.
Just making up.
No, that's right.
Could you talk a little bit about how
sure.
that came to be?
Sure.
And was that pre Steely Dan or post Steely
Dan? Oh, yeah.
Dan?
I was pre. Yeah. That was a long time ago. That's when I first. Well, it was probably just before I moved to New York. It was when I was living in Boston. But it really kind of became kind of an extreme experience when I moved here and made a because part of it was making the decision that I wasn't going to be a jazz player. Like, because I went to Berkeley, and that was all about studying jazz. And when I got out of Berkeley, I studied with this guy, Charlie Vanakis, this fantastic jazz teacher from Boston, for a year. And, you know, it was really shedding that stuff and still kind of thinking of standards as being like a thing that I should practice, just if I wanted to be good. And when I came to New York and realized if I wanted to compete with the cats here, you know, say there's like all at any given moment in New York City, there's maybe like 7 or 8, maybe even 10 guys playing jazz that are phenomenal, right. You know, that are just like the best in the country, probably. I mean, maybe not, but some of the best
probably,
in the country that move here, you know, that kind of converge on New York City to try to play jazz. So I realized that to compete with those guys, I'd have to really devote myself to playing that music. And I didn't, it was kind of like, yeah, I mean, now it's really close and irritating, right?
No, for the audience,
I mean, like the gum chewing like, would be great at this
like
point.
It's like NPR now.
Yeah, right.
No, exactly. I'll get it out.
You know, it just, I realized my heart wasn't in that. And you can't, like if you're in New York, you can't just play a little jazz on the weekend, you know what I mean? It's not that kind of scene.
You got to be all in.
Yeah, like with anything, whatever it is you do here. So I made that decision, and then this kind of conscious, it's kind of a, I don't want to be boring with it, but it's kind of this sort of a long answer to the thing. Basically, it's like the musicians that we all like, all of us, I'm sure anybody listening to this, the musicians we care about the most are people that sound like themselves. There's people that have figured out how to personalize what they do, even if it's a straight idiom player, even talking about a rock and roll guitar player or whatever. There's some, you know, the people that we like the most are the people that figured out how to personalize within their context to the point where they're identifiable and they offer something that you really can't get anyplace else because it's a function of them. And you know, if you just want to be a great jazz player, it's an abstraction, really. It's like, really what like the inspiration is, like these cats, if they're jazz people, talking about George, like George is one of my first jazz inspirations, and Joe Pass, John McLaughlin, let's say those three guys. It's like I realized like almost from the beginning that I was going to be wasting my time trying to imitate those guys. You know, you learn from them, you observe, maybe you cop a thing here or there just to see what it's like to run through the field with their shoes on and all that, but I realized my value was not going to be being a stylist. It wasn't going to be that. It wasn't going to be being a jazz stylist or an imitator. It's like a spectrum of stuff. Everybody's necessary to make the music work in this world. There's an intense need for stylists. There's a need for people who sound like other people. And there's a need for people that try to carve out something more personal. That's all. It's all included in the spectrum. And just like as I became more and more in touch with the fact that my place in that spectrum was going to be more on the personal side, that's when I kind of got intentional with how do I do it? How do I tap into that thing as opposed to just trying to cop Sko's latest record or whatever.
Right.
And so that began that process that I think you're asking about, just like the kind of let me just get rid of all the stuff I'm playing now that's not mine, and which was most of it, because I was into this kind of post-bop long 16th note line playing and stuff. It was still probably somewhat personal at the time, but just conceptually it wasn't creative particularly. It was derivative. So to get rid of that stuff and see what was left, and then whatever's left, I tried to develop that. And that kind of led me towards the rhythm thing, because that turned out to be something that was personal. And, you know, it was kind of a painful process because, at least in my case, I really couldn't play for a while. Because yeah, like once you give that up, there's nothing.
Yeah. There must have been a point of no return where you're like, oh shit, now kinda. I don't really remember some of this other
stuff. Yeah, or just like you've made a commitment not to go there anymore. Yeah, eventually it turns into not remembering. But I mean, there is a part where you could kind of go back. You know, you could keep doing those kinds of gigs. And
like, I want to ask about that. Yeah. Gigs. Like,
what know, gigs?
Working guitarist in New York and then you're shedding all these
right.
chops that you might need to, you know,
that's
pay
for
bills.
Sure. Yeah. No, I didn't pay bills. You know, I relied on generous girlfriends and, you know, my parents sending me money sometimes. And I worked as a temp guy when I first came here. You know, it's not, we're not talking about an economically based decision here. It has nothing to do with that. Like, I always kind of, I think, thought that if I could develop, because I had something personal, I could tell, and I thought it was something that wasn't so abstract, although it's plenty abstract, way too abstract for its own good, but not so abstract that it would be completely without appeal. I thought maybe it would have some kind of appeal on some level to someone. And so I kind of had faith that eventually I'm not going to be a pop star at all, but maybe I'll be able to survive if I just kind of commit to it. And that ended up happening, you know, but it took a long time. And during that middle period, like, because once you commit to being a leader, you stop getting called for being a sideman. At least I did. You know, that's some friends of mine too. It's kind of a common phenomenon.
Yeah.
And but here you are, the leader of what, you know, and nobody knows what the hell you're doing or what that music is or what to call it or you know, what its place in the world is, if any. And so, yeah, it wasn't a business decision at all. It was just like, what's it going to take for me to be happy here? And then once you figure that out, then it's about how can I make money at this? You know, that's one of the places where art and commerce meet. It's like artists first kind of figure out what they want to make, and then they figure out if they want to make a living at that, they figure out how to sell that thing, which is different from making art to sell. Mm-hmm. It's just a different
product.
Thing. And that's
product,
you know, yeah. Look, that's cool too, whatever. You know, it's just, I knew that wasn't how I was going to do it.
Yeah.
I think it's been helpful for me to sort of suspend judgment about any of this thing. We're really just talking about, like, what's going to make you happy? You know, you. What's going to make you happy playing the guitar? You know, like, what's the vibe? You know, and then hopefully you can figure out how to survive doing that. You know, and if not, you do something else, I guess, or something. I don't know. But really, it's not... It's not like this is better than that or any of that, because, you know, there's nothing better than just going down and hearing like a great blues player play in some bar somewhere. You know what I mean? Like, that's as good as anything. It doesn't matter whether every single lick came from the various kings before, you
sure.
know, as long as it sounds good.
It's done with, with
that's
passion.
It. And, yeah.
It's always amazing how, I'm skipping around, but how... Yeah. You pull things off in New York, man. Like,
I know,
and especially
it's impossible, right?
Your music. I'm always amazed. I go to 55 Bar. It's always great, and I go, I wonder if they rehearse this or how they do this. Like,
we
I
were
can
wondering
tell it's
if
a
we
little
rehearsed
sometimes,
it too.
But it's
Sure.
And, you know, and the caliber of musicians you have that play with you, I'm sure you know this by now, but like your gig is looked at as sort of a rite of passage in New York almost. I mean, people come to New York to want to play. You know, I've heard that about a lot of drummers and things. And, you know,
it's a good drummer gig. I'm proud of that part.
You know, Jeremy Stacey is a friend of mine, and we've worked together on other projects. And I was here the first night he played with you.
Oh, yeah.
And he was sweating like crazy. He just flew in, and I said, "Oh man, I came to check you out with Wayne." He goes, "Oh, I don't even know. There's no rehearsal, and Wayne didn't really tell me anything, and I'm really nervous." And I'm like, "Wow, you're nervous?" But you know, he did great.
He did.
But I was like, "How can they do this? Wow, it's amazing to me how it all works."
Yeah, I know. Nothing about New York really makes sense. I mean, it's just. I remember when I first came here, it was just I couldn't imagine how it was going to work. You know, like. All the money that's required, the logistics and the hard stuff. And it's like, how is this even possible? You know, but somehow here I am 30 years later, still, you know, we got a roof up over our head here, you know.
Your intention was to kind of be a jazz cat here, or you just wanted to get out of...
I wanted to play with famous guys and tour the world. Really, that's what I wanted. Famous people, I should say, and tour the world. You couldn't do it from Boston. You certainly couldn't do it from Corvallis, Oregon. Mm-hmm. You know, you got to go where the music is. Mm-hmm. That's what I tell anybody, you know, from Montana or whatever that are just should I come there, you know, it's like go where the music is, whatever your music is, you got to go where it's being made, you know. And this is where anything creative was happening. This was the center. I moved here in 87, and you know, LA was, there's a ton of music there, but not much creative stuff. Mm-hmm. So you know, I mean, if I hadn't gone to Berkeley, if I hadn't gone to college, if I just gotten out of high school and gone down to LA and joined a rock band, which sometimes I kind of wish I'd done, my life would have been different musically, I'm sure. I mean, I don't know what would have happened. But once I moved east and kind of became fascinated with creative music, some of which was jazz, some of which wasn't, you know. And I started meeting people that were making creative music here and realizing that there might be a place for me in groups like that. Groups that didn't have such rigid ideas about what the guitar was supposed to sound like. You know, like most of us are on our sideman gigs, the guitar is supposed to do something, you know, that's expected.
Right.
Every couple of tunes, you're supposed to like trot forward and play a rock and roll solo for the kids and then go back and shut the fuck up for another two or three songs, you know. And that's kind of like what it is for guitar on most sideman gigs. And my thing was just less and less fitting into that, you know, that job description. I mean, for me to be happy.
Were you happy playing with Steely Dan?
Yeah, it was a fun job. I mean, that, you know.
Hey, did you learn all the... you know, that some of those solos are signature.
I didn't, because the reason they hired me was to not do that.
Wow, that's interesting.
That's why they wanted me. I mean, to me, it was like, really? Me? I don't do that stuff, you know.
Oh, I thought it was great when you were with Hawaii. I remember
but it,
that.
No, it had its moments. But yeah, the whole idea was that they didn't want that. I mean, they kind of after me, they kind of went back to kind of splitting the difference on that one. But yeah, they didn't even want me to play the same rhythm parts. You know, they really wanted me to kind of do a ground up thing. And so that's what I tried to do, you know, with all due respect to everything. And if there was something that just had to be played, I probably played it. But yeah, it was interesting. But it was a lot of fun. I mean, I learned a lot. The main thing I learned on that one was I'm sure I've said this endlessly, but this idea of placement, rhythmic placement. Like, that was the first time I'd ever played in a band that had such profoundly centered rhythmic placement. It's completely different from a jazz placement. It's really classic R&B, center of the beat stuff. And I didn't, it was odd. Like, I think when I was in the band, I never really centered on that too well. And it wasn't until some years later that I managed to actually locate the center of the beat as a location and then play from there. And it took a long time to figure that out.
You mean the rhythm playing or just in general, like delivery of parts?
Where the notes are put. Mm-hmm. Like, not the ideas so much.
On like, top of the beat or laid back.
Exactly.
And they're kind of in the center, right?
Dead center.
See, I hear New York drummers like that, like me being from New Orleans, it's everything I play and stuff I grew up listening to is always a little bit on the back end.
Mm-hmm.
And playing up here and working with drummers, like guys, they don't rush. It's like you said, it's right on the beat. It's the precision.
Some guys, yeah, that's true. Although, and, you know, Steely Dan's drummer for the last however many years, Keith Carlock, is like famously behind snare, you know.
Yeah.
And that's what they like. In fact, when they made demos, when Donald Fagen made demos, he would always lag the snare drum back a precise number of clicks in Pro Tools to give it that thing. So yeah, that has to be there for that kind of R&B thing maybe to happen in the way it needs to have the bounce or whatever. Mm-hmm. But in general, their stuff was not rushed and not draggy. You know, it was centered. And my interest after kind of being exposed to that and seeing like these kind of R&B based rhythm sections playing that seemingly effortlessly while I'm like struggling not to rush, I started imagining what that kind of placement would do for my music, which is rhythmically very different from theirs and R&B obviously, but just the element of the placement of it, like to have my thing be that centered, if that would help me, if it would help. And in fact, it did. It like created this clarity of rhythm, because that's what it does. Like that's the clearest way to articulate what a rhythm is to center it. Like that's the most accurate telling of a rhythm that you can give another musician or the audience. You know, and with my stuff, which tends to be a little obscure rhythmically, like it's not all obvious what's happening, it really helps if at least it's centered so that the intent of it can be clearly received by the other musicians initially, but then, you know, even subliminally by the audience, even though they don't know from that and don't care about it, you know. But to achieve some kind of clarity, I found it really, and plus everything's just way funkier that way.
Mm-hmm.
And sure. That's the essence of, that's the groove. That's what it is. I mean, underneath everything.
When you went through that period of reinventing yourself, that the Steely, first of all,
that happened later, Steely Dan stuff.
That happened later, but Billy Cobham, was that before Laney? You were playing with Laney?
It was sort of during, actually. During. Laney was the first thing I did in New York, other than Carl LeBlay Band, which is what I got when I first came down here. I auditioned for that and got that. And then through that band, which was the Sextet at the time, I subbed for Hiram Bullock on that band.
Did you just come to New York cold?
Totally.
Wow.
Yeah. It took a year. It took a year of nothing before something started falling into place. But it was after I met Laney. And I'd known Mike in Boston, but I met Laney through that gig. They came to see it, and she was doing something. I got involved with her. And that was really my first kind of New York, local 55 bar. We started playing there. Or she was already playing there. And that's where I really met everybody, through that gig, because she just had all the bass players and drummers in town playing with her. So that was great. It was a good experience for me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's a clip of you guys in Germany that's killing on that, too. I think it's Phoenix, actually.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, it's a...
I'm doing my post-bop thing. Long lines, 16
notes.
They're
a long line. There's some long lines. Yeah. They're slamming, man.
Good.
It's really... It's really nice. Great. I think Zach Danziger's playing.
Probably. That's how I met my first band came out of Laney's bands. Zach and Lincoln both played with her. So that's how I met them and became friendly enough to ask them to rehearse for no money. got to play with your friends.
Thanks, everybody. I just want to introduce these guys, these incredible musicians that I've been playing with for about a year now. One of the things I love that you do that is like a signature thing of yours is the tempo changes. It's almost a metric modulation thing, but I think you just give cues. Is that it? Up, down, kind of.
Yeah.
And man, it's so effective when it kicks in the audience. You can just hear everybody.
It's a thing.
Where did you get that idea from?
I got it from a record that I made, actually, called Greenwich Mean.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Which was a bunch of live edits spliced together. Some of them having absolutely nothing to do mathematically with tempo-wise with what was before or after it. So I just did it in a way that sounded cool to me. That sounded almost like a random drop, random DJ drop.
Oh.
And then I wanted to imitate that live. So that's what we did, And to do that, meanwhile, if you look at the history of it, James Brown was doing stuff like that. Mm-hmm. Prince did it. They had their way of doing it. It's an R&B thing to do, I guess, and probably other musics too. But in our case, the whole goal is to have it not sound like metric modulation, to have it not sound mathy, but to have it sound kind of random and surprising. Yeah. And what was that?
It's always surprising. It doesn't sound, cerebral at all.
That's the goal.
Yeah.
That's the goal.
It doesn't sound like that.
Not that there's anything wrong with that, but it's just I didn't want to create that effect.
Sure.
It's already too cerebral. The music's already too heady for its own good. So I'm always looking for ways to kind of drag it down into the dirt. And that was so that it's earthy enough so that people can dig it,
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the things that... And also, it's just this relentless mission to try to figure out how to not make the music boring, which it can be just instantly, so fast. It can get so boring to listen to people jamming on a groove. That can really... It's fun for us, but to get people to come and to have the consistency happen of it being it's different all the time, and this changed, and that was a wake-up call, and all that stuff... it's looking for things and ways in the music to provide that for the audience so they don't just go to sleep.
Yeah, well, you do that really well, man.
Sometimes
I love the where you tell the bass player to lay out and then you'll just be playing with the drummer
it's the same exact idea. It's how can we change whatever is happening, no matter how badass it is, has to change or it's going to become boring.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter what it is.
Sure.
So and since it's not, some people write in those kinds of changes into the tune. It's composed. It's part of the show. Like in this tune, we're going to go this way with the thing, and in this tune, we're going to go that way, and on this one, it's going to acoustic guitar feature, and on this one, it's going to be this kind of lighting. Like that's what the show thing does, is it creates a contour, so it's not just one thing. Mm-hmm. Because no matter how good it is, it's going to get dull. So with us, there is no show. The music is the show. And it's also, by the way, not written. So it's like we have to be able to improvise stuff that creates difference within the music. And that thing you just mentioned, like cueing people in and out, that's another thing, like the tempo changes, that does that. It's not as if I have, believe me, like if I cue, sometimes I'll just say, I got it. Mm-hmm. You know, like both of them will go out.
Yeah,
it's
not
as if I have anything planned at that point. I have nothing planned. It's just like, this is getting boring. Let's get these guys out of here. I'll do something and then I'll cue them back in. And maybe where we land that time will be more interesting than it was. It's that kind of thing. But yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, because as a listener, and I think I have fairly good ears, and I can discern from things that are worked out. And I mean, it's just, it's enjoyable.
I'm glad.
I try to disconnect myself from guitars. You know,
that's cool.
I can hear the whole thing. And the way you're turning things on and off, you know, telling the drummer layout this or that. I mean, it's just enjoyable. That's why I was, and
glad.
Not just me. I mean, everybody digs it.
That's cool.
I love the stuff you start with the delay sometimes and just you by yourself mm-hmm. and it comes in, you know.
I always feel like that's cheating in a way.
Why is that?
You know, because it's a delay pedal. It's like, hey man, you want to play solo? Play solo,
but
baby.
You do that without the delay,
no,
too.
No, I do. I do sometimes, but it's, you know, that's...
Well, tell that to the Edge and you wouldn't have had you too, probably.
Well, yeah, that's true.
That's kind of part of it.
It's no, like I do, you know, the right delay arm. Thing is super fun, you know, I always... But I just, you know, sometimes I do feel like... You can rely too much on stuff like that.
Well, it's not like it's a super fancy delay. I've never seen anybody squeeze so much out of that. What is it, a DD3 Boss?
Yes, DD3.
I can't believe how many. And there's no tap tempo,
no,
so you're
no.
just doing it all manually.
Yeah.
You know
so I was talking about this with my wife the other day. Sometimes, because she's a musician too, and she also is a little bit into the pedals, and it's like, we're saying like sometimes it doesn't, especially if it's not tap, if you're just winging it and hoping it works out. Like half the time, it just won't behave. It just won't work, you know. And like I sort of persist for a little while, but at some point, I just write it off. I say, look, it's just not happening today. You know, it's got its own. It's off. It's on vacation today.
That's and the ring modulator is super hip. That's mm-hmm. kind of your thing too. Now, I mean, if anybody else does it, I guess McLaughlin did it, but not in the
he
way
did.
That you
well,
did.
Was it? Did
I
he
mean,
do
he
it, or did
once,
did Jan Hammer used it?
Well,
I know Jan Hammer
used
maybe
it. Maybe he used it, but yeah. It's not in the way you're doing it. I mean, it's super hip. It's just
that's cool.
And now it's like your thing. Like to me, if somebody else did it, it sounds like me.
Well, despite that, the you know Mooger Fooger companies have not been chasing me down for any endorsement
really?
Opportunities.
Well, maybe, so. I don't know. Maybe. Somebody that knows them will hear this.
That's cool. I'm good.
Try to play something?
Yeah, what are you gonna play? Thank you.
Great. I had a friend named Bill Hart. I don't know if you remember. He used to teach in Atlanta. Player? Yeah.
I know Bill.
Yeah. And Bill had come to New York, and I was like, wow, you're going to New York, you know? And he goes, yeah, I'm taking a lesson with Wayne Krantz. And we all had...
Oh, wow.
We all had the... Yeah, yeah, he took a lesson. And this is a pretty funny story. So, I mean, I'm talking, this was like 1992 or 93. Bill came back with this cassette. You know, like, this is my lesson with Wayne. Please, can I get a copy? Please, please. So he made it. I had it for a while. And I remember you were, and we could talk about this after, but part of the lesson was you talking about how you isolate like Dorian to like this position and force yourself to play.
That's
that
the
position.
Four fret exercise. That's the foundation of my book right
there. Okay, yeah. We can talk about it in a minute.
Great.
And so Bill had this tape in it, and I asked Bill a few years ago, I said, man, you still have that lesson with Wayne Krantz? I'd love to hear it. And he goes, I can't find it. I don't know what happened to it. Well, guess what? I found it on a cassette.
Oh, wow.
About 2 years ago. That's true. I dumped it over into Pro Tools and edited, you know, and sent him a copy of it. And it's really great. And
that's
it's
cool.
You talking about everything we're just talking about. You were talking about shedding this and that.
Uh-huh.
I remember Bill said, man, Wayne's apartment, you could sit on the edge of the bed and take your guitar and touch the wall.
That was Thompson Street. Yeah, I lived there for 10 years.
Well, this is
like
half.
It was probably the size of this room, the entire apartment probably.
Wow.
It wasn't configured in the same way, but yeah, it was super. I mean, I was traveling a lot then, so it kind of worked, and I wasn't married or anything, so it sort of worked.
And I remember on the cassette, you can hear him. You can hear you say, "We can't play too loud here, so let me turn it down a little bit."
Oh wow! I'm surprised there was even an amp involved.
There was an amp.
That's surprising.
Yeah, but anyway, but yeah. So, so maybe that's a good segue into that four fretter, because I remember practicing that off of that cassette. You know,
I was just looking for ways to get into this. You know, because I think because I went to Berkeley, and also because when I was going to Berkeley, my heroes at the time were jazz guys. I kind of shed the rock thing that got me there from the West Coast where I was from, and sort of became fascinated with the jazz guys, and because I was drawn by the complexity of it, like that fascinated me, you know, and. I mean, not that I come from anything like that, or that I like standards. I don't. I happen not to enjoy those songs. But I was just fascinated by, like, how is this even possible? You know, how do people do it? So, like, through that, I got this idea in my head that I should know my scales and chords. You know, like, I should know the theory stuff on the guitar, which by itself is, like, totally unnecessary. I mean, it's just a decision somebody makes. Most of my favorite players probably have no idea what that stuff is. Mm-hmm. You know, seriously doubt whether Hendrix knew what a Dorian scale was. I mean, he knew the sound of it, but he didn't know it was called that,
right.
And he hardly ever played it. But I just kind of got it in my head that it was important if I wanted to be good to do my homework with that stuff. So that's a decision, like to take that on. Like, not everybody has to make that, and there's all kinds of different viewpoints about whether you should make it and all that stuff. But because of my experience and, you know, who I was listening to and where I was at the time, I thought it was important. But I also was kind of getting in touch with this idea that I wanted to be an improviser. I don't mean just a soloist, like I don't mean taking a solo that's based on licks and patterns and shapes and stuff, but like most solos are,
mm-hmm.
most blues, most rock, a lot of jazz, but actually being able to be spontaneously creative, but without forsaking like the scales and chord thing, you know, like somehow figuring out how to put those together, because the scale and chord thing is taught as pattern, it's taught as shapes, it's taught as position, it's taught as learn the scale here, playing in order, play it in order, learn the scale there, play it in order, learn the modes of that, play them in order, learn the inversions of the chords. It's very pattern based, and I was just of a mind that these patterns are just getting in my way. I mean, first of all, I can't use it musically on the gig. I can't use any of the stuff that I've been practicing for years on the gig. You know what I mean? Like, I can sit and practice Phrygian for 5 hours in position up and down the guitar, but if I go and try to make music of that, I would fall flat on my face.
Yeah.
And so I was just trying to figure out, like, how can I figure out how to practice that stuff, feel like I was doing my homework, being my, you know, a responsible little guitar player, but also in some way that was actually going to be able to be useful if I wanted to actually avail myself of that stuff as music. And so that led me to this thing you're talking about, which is more like an exercise to make me better, make anybody better, at rather than knowing the pattern for a Phrygian scale, for example, having that muscle memory, finger memory, pattern down so you can whip it out fast.
Right.
To be able to access that thing more spontaneously on the guitar, which requires not knowing it as a pattern, but knowing how the scale is made, knowing the notes that are in it, knowing how they relate to the root, and being able to basically find those. Like, what's 1 flat, 2 flat, 3, 4, 5, flat 6, flat 7 for that scale? So if it's an E flat, you know, like I don't know what I'm doing here, but for example, like say my hand is here, you know, and I want to make an E flat Phrygian sound. Like, unless I know it as a pattern, which might be something like that, right? Knowing it as like that kind of,
right.
Knowing it as a shape.
Right.
If my hand's here, I don't know the shape for it. But say I want to play the sound of it, like to do that. I sort of have to be able to find the notes of it like. Like right now, there's the fifth, here's flat 2, 1, flat 7, flat 6, 1, 5, flat 3, 5, 4, flat 3. And I want to play some chords from it, so I know I need 1 and flat 7 and flat 3 and flat 2. Right? It's like there's a little three note Phrygian chord that I just found.
A cluster kind of.
Yeah. That is. I call that harmonic playing. Like, I'm still improvising. I don't know this shape. I don't know this as a chord. I'm just looking for notes that are in the thing.
Right.
So that I can create the sound of that scale in that key musically. Right?
Right.
So to do that, to get access to the guitar like that, and not just for that scale, but the 2048 other scales that are available. Like, that's the other thing that was bugging me at the time. Why should I just satisfy myself? I'm going to do this. Why just do the 15 or 16 scales that Berkeley told me I needed to know? And actually, coincidentally and respectfully, do cover most of the chords that we ever run into.
Right.
But still, there's other stuff out there, you know. So I was just trying to kind of like make some kind of sense about how can I practice this stuff so that I can play Phrygian if I want. I mean, not that I ever want to, honestly, but say I did. I can creatively. I can, in a way, like with the baddest groove, you know. Where am I? Here.
I'm just
playing notes from the scale, but I'm playing music with those mm-hmm. notes, which I wouldn't be able to do if the only way that I could play chords, for example, that were part of that, were shapes that I knew.
Yeah.
And inversions of those shapes. Like, that wouldn't let me mix up the melody and the harmony like
sure.
that, or it wouldn't let me be spontaneous with it. I could kind of arrange stuff that I know spontaneously, which is how good lick players do it, which is fine. I mean, there's absolutely nothing in the world wrong with that. Some of my favorite stuff, some of all of our favorite stuff. But if you do want to improvise, at least like in the way I'm defining it here, which is basically spontaneously generating stuff, which is what you hear me doing down there and the guys, then it required a different system of learning the theory on the guitar. So that's what that exercise is. It's just a different way to do it that doesn't depend. Like, there's no memory required. Zero. There's zero. I mean, you have to know how to play some intervals on the guitar, I guess. I mean, you sort of have to know what a minor third looks like on the mm-hmm. guitar. That's very helpful. I use that all the time. But I don't have to remember any chords or lines or licks or anything, you know, if I don't want to.
Mm-hmm.
And usually I don't.
And that's what your book.
That's what the
Improvisers
book is.
OS.
Yeah,
is.
Which I just rewrote, by the way. It's coming out just now. Second edition of that book. So it's got a bunch of additional stuff in it.
Yeah, I'll put a link up to that.
Great.
And this gets,
I'd appreciate that. But yeah, that's what that is. And at the time, that Bill would have done that. That's right around the period where really that whole thing became like I really figured it out how I was going to do it. And so I started teaching that stuff. And I did that. I really practiced that way pretty exclusively for a long time, many years.
You want to talk about your new record you were telling me you were writing for?
Actually, I started recording, actually. It's going to be a layered thing. It's not live. None of it's live. I got sidetracked with this revision on this book, this rewrite I just did. I just finished it a couple days ago.
How much more different is
it's,
it than the
it's
previous
way
version?
Different. I mean, it has all the stuff that the first book has that matters, but it ended up. Yeah, I was just gonna like add a chapter just to update it from what everything that had happened for the last 15 years, and it just ended up being like a lot more involved than that. So that took some time actually to get that done, but now that it's done, I have all the bass tracks for the record. I'm gonna do some kind of rhythm guitar stuff next, I think, and then add some other cats. And you know, it's all composed right now. It's all there's maybe a few solos here and there, but not many. It's mostly composed stuff. And then I'm gonna listen to that and then see how it needs to be balanced in terms of, you know, so it doesn't sound like too dry. I'm kind of counting on drums to provide. Drums and percussion, maybe, to provide a lot of juice, you know, to the composed stuff. But if that's not enough, then I'll do some other stuff too. But yeah, that's kind of now coming into my field of vision, front and center.
Nice.
Not the book's over.
Just sort of open ended whenever you get it done?
Of course it is. It's like all my records. I mean, nobody, you know, there's no machine. I'm not part of a machine of any kind, so there are no demands made. Which is great in one way. I mean, creatively, it's great. But you know, some people that think that nothing can get finished without a deadline. I mean, I sort of am okay at initiating my own deadlines. You know.
Yeah.
I'm not sure.
Well,
hopefully this year.
Yeah.
You know, I hope.
That's good. There's still a lot left to the year. I used to like getting your I've downloaded all of your the MP3 lessons that you used to post years ago.
Mm-hmm.
I still listen to those sometimes, and it's really inspiring because it's just you practicing, and it's like you with the tape recorder,
whatever
it was, and the way you would practice. And one of the things I took away from that was you talked a lot about rhythm and playing with a metronome and different ways to use it. But I remember one too where you would just string together unrelated chords and then improvise over that.
Okay.
Or you would improvise over the chords with no changes.
Right.
And then play the solo back.
That's
and
right.
And then play the changes over the solo.
The first of those two, like where you're just improvising over random chords, if they are really random, then it's an ear exercise. That's what that's for. But if you're soloing over changes that without a rhythm track, then it becomes like a theory exercise.
But it's an interesting way to practice because I'm guilty. Well, not guilty, but I mean, you know, playing over standards because I don't know what else to practice sometimes over. You want something a little challenging, but it's not the most original thing. Like you need another version of Stella, you know.
And, look, here's what I think about that, man. Like there's certainly nothing in the world wrong with practicing Stella. Nothing. But if it's not making you happy,
if you're
feeling what you're saying now, which is like, gee, I kind of wish there was something else. Like that's the point where maybe there should be something else. You know, like, it's not because the world says you're supposed to do this or you're not supposed to, or Django did it so you have to, or any of that. I believe it's just, what is getting us off here? You know, what are we digging here? And if your desire is to have some more challenging harmony to work on as a soloist, then yeah, then and you're getting tired of playing Stella by Starlight for whatever reason, whether it's you're just tired of it or you don't think it fits with you anymore or whatever it is, then it's two options. It's like either find other songs that have complicated stuff in it that aren't Stella, or write some songs that have complicated harmony in them, which I think is a nice solution to the problem, because then it creates music, and that's good. It's good for you to write. That's a good thing for you to do in this world, you know, make something. And it could be with the same kind of chords even. You know, you could use that same kind of jazz harmony if you wanted to, with minor 2/5s and sub 5s and all that stuff, you know. Needless to say, none of that is happening in pop music right now. So, like, pop music now, I mean, I feel somewhat of an authority to say this because I have a 14-year-old daughter who listens exclusively to that music, so I hear it. And it's very, very limited harmonically. Very, very. It's very, very sophisticated rhythmically because of the production. It's like whoever's, you know, producing a lot of these tracks, they know what they're doing rhythmically. But harmonically, there's not much there. And also melodically, there's not much there. It's mostly riff-oriented or just rhythmic. It's rap-based or like R&B riff-based stuff with minimal harmony. So you can't really get much from that stuff right now in terms of like what kind of work on that's not Stella. So that makes me think, you know, you'd either go back to whatever, 70s, 60s, or write some stuff. And that random chord thing is good for that, because it's just, you know, like, there's an infinite number of ways to do it, but one way you could do it is just make a tape of yourself playing some, with a metronome, just, you know, on the first bar of every four bars, or four beats, on beat one of each bar, play a different chord. It doesn't matter what it is. And then let it hang for a day, and then go back and try to blow over it. You know, like, that's a good ear exercise.
Yeah.
But again, you know, it depends what your goal is. You know, it's like, is your goal to sound impressive on standards? Like, if that's your goal, you've got to play standard. You've got to practice standards. Yeah. Like, that's what I mean. When I first moved here, I realized that I was going to suspend that goal, even though I loved it. I loved hearing people doing it. I was reasonably okay at doing it myself, you know. But I really realized at that moment that I don't love it enough to really continue doing it, and so I put it away.
I think YouTube's an amazing thing. I want to get your idea on it, your thoughts. But now you have guys who, like, they don't really do gigs. They just post things to YouTube.
Mm-hmm.
And
you don't dig it?
I'm not saying I don't dig it. I'm just wondering where it's headed. Is that the new audience? Is that the new gig now? Like, YouTube? Like, you know, there are guys that maybe they're reaching more people than they would if they could get a gig at, you know, Bitter End or something like that. I don't know. But some of these guys have never done gigs before, ever. Mm-hmm. And I'm not
this isn't a knock on anybody. I'm just wondering, like, where are we headed?
Yeah.
Because I notice, like, a lot of cats kind of sound the same, too, now.
You think because of that?
I think so.
Yeah?
I think so, because there's no mystery anymore. You know, back when I had, first time I heard you or any other guitar player that I looked up to and listened to, there was a mystery, like, I had to figure out.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, you didn't know what kind of guitar you played or what you were using. It was part of the appeal, and that search helped you develop. Now it's just like, man, it's instantaneous. I mean,
that's true. Yeah, no, it's definitely different. I mean, I have a lot of faith in performance. Like, I really think there's a reason why it still happens. You know, I think it's built into, we're hardwired with that one. I think human beings need to perform and they need to witness performance. And I think that's part of what we are, period. And I don't think anything can change that in the same way it doesn't change our desire to have, you know, families and everything, friends and all the other stuff that's, you know, essential. So I kind of have faith in it to the point where I don't feel like it's in danger from a technology. That said, I don't think it hurts anybody that I haven't actually seen these guys you're talking about. The only thing I see on YouTube is, like, when I need inspiration, I go to classic people. Dead people mostly. The main thing I relate to with what you're saying is, like, the mystery thing. It's like the whole, even doing this podcast, you know, here I am, like laying it all out, you know, and Miles didn't do that. You know, it's like the cats in the old days that used to inspire me. I mean, Hendrix actually gave a lot of interviews. It's true. And he probably would have done podcasts if he'd been asked to.
Well, I haven't found a lot of, I'm a podcast fan. I listen to a few different ones, and for years I looked anything with you on it. I haven't found.
Well, that's true. There haven't been a lot. I did one recently for, like, these English cats.
And I heard it. And I was wondering, that's why I was a little hesitant to ask you initially. I was like, well, I don't know if Wayne's into that.
No, it's not that I've said no. It's that I haven't been asked.
Well, that's amazing.
I mean, really. I'm going to do somebody asked me to do, I don't know, I can't remember the name of it, but one of those things, podcasts, I'm going to do in August. But in a way, you know, and the label that I work with has constantly encouraged me to be more engaged with social media and all this stuff. And he kind of, you know, he said something the other day that kind of made sense, really. He's saying, look, if you had a choice between seeing a picture of Ringo Starr playing the drums or seeing a video of him brushing his teeth, which one would you pick? And I said, actually, probably the video, if I had to choose one. He said, yeah, because you've seen a picture of him playing the drums, like, countless times, but you've never seen a video of him brushing his teeth. And we were laughing about that, and I was sort of thinking about it. It's like, there goes the mystery, you know? It's like, that's how Ringo brushes his teeth? Wow. Well, now I know, you know? Next, I mean, the problem with that is, you got to keep making videos we've never seen, right?
You got to feed
the monster.
Feed the monster.
But
when I had Daryl Hall on, I mean, I work with Daryl all the time, and it took me forever before he said from day one, he's like, well, I didn't know you had a podcast. I'll be on it. I was like, are you kidding me? You want to be on it? He goes, well, you never asked me. And I go, well, I mean, you said no to Tom Brokaw. Like, you figure, you know, my little shitty podcast. He's like, I want to do it. Well, that was a year it took me to
get
him
to do it.
And then he was like, well, let's, maybe tomorrow we can do it when we're done with the. Yeah. So one asset, that's it, man. The shit's set up, and we were in a studio. That's it. And he just talked. You know, natural. Done a million interviews.
Sure.
But he won't listen to anything.
Uh huh.
And all these people would email me and his manager. Wow, it's a great interview with Daryl. It's candid. And I said, Daryl, did you check it out? He goes, I don't listen to anything. I've never listened to anything.
Yeah.
I thought that was interesting.
That's actually kind of how I am, I have to say.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty much. Right now, somebody's asked me this the other day, because, you know, people shoot video at 55, and I haven't seen it. And they asked about that, and like, I'm in a place now where I enjoy playing so much, and I I'm connected to it in the way that I'd like to be. I mean, at least I'm on the road to being connected to it in the way I'd like to be, the music, more so than ever. And I sort of don't want to interfere with that feeling right now by judging it, because I know as soon as I look at it, that's the next
kind of thing.
Well, it's just judgment comes into it at that point. And I don't want to interfere right now. Like to me right now, it's more important that I'm connected in the right way than whether it sounds good. It's just like it hit that point. Like, that is my priority right now. At some point, I'm going to be ready to tweak the way it sounds. Once this connection thing is established, like beyond question, then maybe I'll go back and start tweaking it and saying, oh, that's what that sounds like? Fuck that. I'm not going to do that again. I'm going to do this instead. Or that's what it looks like when I do that? Mm-hmm. Oh, wow, it's not cool, you know. And I just don't want to interfere with the vibe right now by that.
Sure. Well, that's...
But you know, I'll listen to your podcast. I'll listen to this. Hell
well,
yeah.
You know what? I put in
especially
little,
after it's edited.
I put in little edits, and I'll put like little excerpts from some of your songs.
Ah, whatever.
And flow
if you
in
want.
And out, you know.
Yeah.
As long as
it's
I
cool.
don't get sued, I'll do it. I'm interested in, you know, your first Wayne Krantz solo gigs. Were you terrified, like, or were you always kind of feeling comfortable, like, you know, being in a comfortable spot, like? Because I was telling you at 55 Bar, I'm asking it sort of a selfish question because, you know, a couple of solo gigs I've done,
yeah.
I did a couple of Bitter End and a couple of things. Man, I was terrified.
Really?
And they went well. Yeah, decent turnout.
Yeah.
And it was okay and
it's
it
cool.
sounded good. And,
yeah.
But man.
And it didn't lessen the more you did?
Oh, I only did two.
Oh, okay.
And
well,
then, you know, no. You can put me on stage backing up pretty much anyway. I'm
sure.
Okay.
Uh-huh.
But... My own
what
thing,
part of it is the scariest thing? Like, what's the most terrifying part of it? What
everything
element?
Everything internally in my head, like what you're saying, like, oh, that's probably not cool. I don't know. I'm looking at this guy.
Oh, so you're judging it.
Like it. I'm constantly judging.
While you're playing.
While I'm playing.
So you're disconnected.
And I'm worried about, you know, the technical things and the,
sure.
the you know,
man, that's
show up.
Which,
or
the, yeah, what you're talking about right now transcends whether it's your gig or somebody else's. Like, I believe, my opinion is this, that really what you're talking about is your ability to connect with the music if it's your thing. It's really, you're not talking so much about I'm paranoid about or afraid of doing my own thing. It's when you do it, are you still able to connect to the music in the way that apparently you are playing on other people's gigs? Because you're not talking about worrying about those situations at all. So to me, that's the fundamental issue of that we all face all the time. It's about that. It's like, am I going to be able to connect in a way that's going to make this sound, that's going to make, forget about it even sounding good, that's going to make this experience as good as it can be for me and for the audience? Because that only comes when we're most connected. Like, every bit of lack of connection that, as you're describing, you know, worrying about the gear, the sound, am I to this, am I to that? Like, those kinds of thoughts cannot happen while music is happening in you. Like, you have to stand apart from the music for the judgment. That's the thing I was talking about before. It's like, the judgment is when you say, does this... I mean, we, as musicians, we're always shifting and changing in how we play a note and what note we play to try to make it sound good. So in some way, that does involve judgment. But there's a certain kind of judgment that's really kind of more instinct, a musician's instinct to know what to play right now to make it sound good. I think judgment is maybe some kind of factor in that. Like, all those kinds of thoughts can only happen, like, you can't be listening and thinking that. It requires that you step away from the music. And when you do that, you know, we're good players, so we can still play and the gig goes on, but you're compromised at that point. And mm-hmm. and there's no way that it can be as pleasurable as it might be. And those feelings are unpleasant and you're left at the end of the gig thinking like, wow, I was too scared to really enjoy that like I want to or like I think I might be able to or whatever. And so to me, the issue becomes, how do we connect even in adverse conditions? Like, even when there's more on the line, or even when it's less rehearsed, or there's somebody in the audience listening that we're afraid of, or there's nobody there, or there's too many people there, or it doesn't pay enough, or pays too much, or whatever it is, you know. Mm-hmm. It's like, how do we connect through that stuff? And because I just believe that that's where satisfaction is. That's where that feeling at the end of the gig, like, yep, gave it 100%. Did I gave it everything I had. Like, that's beyond judgment at that point. It's like, you can't do any better right. than that. Like, there's incidentals, this happened, that happened, whatever.
Well, when I watch you, I mean, I watch you, you know, you turn the amp on and you close your eyes and just go. I mean, you won't even open your eyes for like the whole
time. I'm trying, man. I'm trying now. I tried that last week. And that's my new thing, opening my eyes.
And I'm like, wow, I wonder what's going through his head. That's what I always think when I watch other musicians, because it's like fearless. That's the best way I could describe what I hear. It's like fearless.
Well,
taking chances. And
I mean, you know exactly what's going on in my head because that's what you're listening to. You know, there isn't anything else. That's all there is. That's exactly what's going through my head, like what I'm playing. And unless I'm distracted. If I'm distracted, then God knows what's going through my head. Mm-hmm. And the experience that you're getting will not be optimal. It might still be really good, mm-hmm. but it's not going to be as good as I want it to be. And on some level, I believe it's not going to be as good as you want it to be too. Like, I think when you're talking about great performances, I put this on my website once because somebody was asking about what I've been listening to or something, and I mentioned like a place I go to for inspiration about connection. Although you can go to any great performance, any performance you think is great on YouTube or on record, you can go to that for inspiration about what connection does, because those are all people that are connected. I'm convinced they figured out how to connect. And this one place that I go for inspiration sometimes for that is the Hendrix at Woodstock video. You know, you think of, and I've read about the day and everything, and the number of distractions that he was facing that day, like between staying up all night and being dosed and not sleeping and brand new band that was terrible, new tunes that nobody knew, half-assed audience that had already started leaving, piles of garbage, movie cameras everywhere, they're making a feature-like film out of the thing, you know. Like, everything that could have pulled him away from the music was present and right in his face, and he still managed to connect. You can see it. Mm. Like, you know, at times you can sort of see he becomes momentarily distracted, but those times do not last. He makes a soul connection with the music, and he just blasts through it. To me, that's like, I get goosebumps just thinking about that. Mm-hmm. Like, what level of commitment to connection that, or however he thought of it. Like, I'm not saying he used these words at all with himself, but that's how I think about it. And there's probably a bunch of stuff like that that you could go to just as a reminder of like what people are capable of, you know, how they're able to make something happen that's beautiful, even if there's all these things against it, you know, that could prevent it, that could interfere with it, interrupt it, you know. So that, to me, that's kind of a essential question that a musician sooner or later has to ask, is like, how am I going to really give myself here to 100% to this thing without distraction, you know?
Thank you.
volume one.
Yeah.
Sounds great, man.
Well, thank you, Wayne, for coming over, man.
My pleasure,
I really
entirely.
Really appreciate it. The jackhammer stayed silent long enough.
All right, if you guys made it this far, like I said, you're a true fan. And thank you so much for hanging in there. Hope you got some good stuff on this. I could easily break these up into probably two parts, but I'd rather have it all in one go. And you can listen to it as you like in sections. So again, visit me, Instagram, Shane Terrio Guitar, or Facebook, Shane Terrio Music. Hit me up with a like, nice comment on iTunes for Riff Raff. Thanks for listening. See you next time.